Accession number 13271, reel 3.
Yes, I was talking about the damage to the surface fleet that Trident would cause, and I do believe that this is now coming to pass. And we're having these really heavy cuts and big decisions required now. And I was talking to Captain Sharp, as I said, editor of Jane's Fighting Ships, only about 2 months ago, and he agreed with me that by 2010, under current plans, the Royal Navy will probably consist of about 10 mine hunters, maybe about 10 or a dozen frigates, a few support ships, and a nuclear submarine force of four Trident and about 8 or 9 attack submarines. That will be the Royal Navy. And this is the result of ruthless vested interest by the nuclear submarine mafia. I mean, they're known in the Navy as the Black Mafia, the submariners anyway, and they have very much taken over the submarine service. And one of the particularly depressing things about the current cuts is that I gather that there is serious consideration being given to mothballing the brand new upholder class of conventional submarine before they're even commissioned, in order to be able to keep the nuclear submarine fleet going. And that, to me, is a disaster for the Navy.
So this mafia, you know, this is very interesting. Are these sort of Navy people?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm being facetious in calling them the mafia, but they are known as the Black Mafia. They are a very high-calibre team, of course, because they have made sure that they've got the best men for the submarine service, and that's always, of course, good, but it does mean that naturally they have come to the top, and they are they've got very good representation in the naval staff, and I just feel that they have been given their head, and that this is potentially disastrous for the future of the Royal Navy as a balanced force that has a capability for all the tasks that are going to be required of it in the future, which are now coming foremost to do with the United Nations peacekeeping, humanitarian disaster relief, and peace building as well. The whole business of diplomacy and spreading the flag, you can't do it in submarine. And you know, the Royal Navy is going under because of Trident. And that was my real fear. And I saw no discussion about it, and I felt that I could not serve in the Royal Navy with Trident with full commitment.
How far do you think the politicians have a role in that? You know, you say this naval, they have
yes,
the naval.
Yes, of course, the politicians had a central role, and the Navy is the servant of the government. And Mrs. Thatcher, particularly, I think, has responsibility here. But I fear that the whole British political scene has become addicted to nuclearism. It's not just the Conservatives. Labour felt that this is what lost them the 1983 election, and so they have now tried to outmacho the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats likewise. And so there is no debate. You cannot get a cigarette paper between the policies of the three main political parties on nuclear. And so who does one go to in terms of getting a balance in this debate? I just see my father come by. I have a feeling we... So let me just come back now to my last job in the Navy, which I haven't really talked much about. I was Staff Officer Intelligence to Commander-in-Chief Fleet, and my primary responsibility was to run the team providing round-the-clock intelligence support to Polaris. And I was able to rationalise that at the time. Remember, this was 1980, when the Soviets were throwing their weight about. They'd just gone into Afghanistan. They were pressurising Poland. They were producing a new warship almost every other month. And they seemed to be on the march. And I felt that Polaris was a minimum deterrent. I had swallowed the propaganda line about it, and I obviously was privy to the way it was being run. It seemed to be being run very conscientiously. very high caliber people. And all I did was brief the command teams as they prepared for the next patrol. And I got to know them. And there were four submarines. Of course, there were two crews, port and starboard crew for each submarine. And always there was one in refit, one coming out. And therefore, there were two running boats. So there were sort of four crews generally coming through in rotation for me to brief. And my intelligence centre, which is actually called the Joint Maritime Intelligence Centre, was in the bunker in Northwood. And it was joint because it was with the RAF Coastal Command. And I had a team of about 40, mainly Wrens, and they were split into four shifts, or four watches, going round the clock in keeping the Soviet plot up to date. And the idea was that we would draw in all the intelligence of the Soviet deployments at the time from the various sources that were available to us, and plot them and then pass out regular summaries to the Polaris operations room, which was almost next door, but we seldom ever went into. And if we did go into it, they pulled down a screen over the plot so we couldn't see where the Polaris submarine was. There was no need for us to know. And I had a Fleet Chief Petty Officer in charge of each watch, very high caliber, very experienced men, not necessarily intelligence specialists, come from all branches of the Navy, but they were very... they were the best, specially selected for their reliability and steadiness and experience. And so it was a joy to have them to look after. And then backing up them was a small day staff of one Wren officer, second officer, as was called then. I still find it very difficult to get used to the new women's ranks, equality. And a couple of daytime, a petty officer Wren, and there was also an ex-Navy officer, civilian analyst, particularly on the submarine side. That was in my main office. Then next door, there was my own communications centre, which was very high security clearance for getting through the highest level of raw data from GCHQ or from the Americans. And I had a similar watch-keeping system of communications Wrens running that. And there was a retired commander who used to run the registry and supervise the communications centre. So that was my team. And it was a very responsible job, and it was very satisfying. Quite the most fascinating job I had in the Navy. And I, of course, was completely new to intelligence. I had to do just a brief course at Ashford before going into this, and the good traditional role of the Royal Navy, always liking an amateur approach to these things, but there was no professional intelligence branch, of course. I had to pick it up, really, as I went along.
You were saying at this time there was no perceived Soviet threat, you felt?
Oh, yes. I think that there was more evidence than there had ever been before for the Soviets being expansionist. And so my whole... sort of pitch that I was putting across all the time was that here was the evidence and this is what they're getting, and it's very good. It's much better than what we've got, and they're expanding all the time, and they are following the theory that Gorshkov had always been pushing out for years, and now this is it. Here we go. And so I'm afraid this worst-case scenario was reasonably plausible at the time. And it was my job to keep people up to date about it. And I accepted it at the time. And then, of course, came the Falklands War, which was a complete aberration, and came right at the end of my time. And it was very strange, because what had happened was that in December 1981... the government announced what was called the Knot Defence Review. And this was after the Secretary of State for Defence at the time, John Knot. And it was going to be very severe, and they were asking for voluntary redundancies, including from commanders. And I was actually offered this at Christmas 81, and we had a month in which to make up our minds and step in for it. And I thought about it very carefully over Christmas with my wife and decided that this was the right moment for me to go. And it was mainly to do with my career future. I could see that it was flattening out, and my heart was not in it because of the reasons I have described. And so I applied. But it was very traumatic. And I then had to keep quiet about it while it was being considered for another 2 or 3 months. And I actually got the letter giving approval for me to go 1 week into the Falklands War, which was exactly the opposite to what you are normally expecting if you're going to leave the Navy. You expect to be put out to grass for some quiet number to pursue your future career for about 18 months or something. And instead, I'd never worked so hard in my life. This was war. I'd never experienced war before. And it actually was an extraordinary climax to my career. And I could literally say that I went out on the crest of a wave, applying all my experience and training, and very well motivated because a lot of my friends were down there getting hurt. And it also was completely fascinating, of course, to be at the nerve centre of the whole war. And more than that, I was involved in the run-up to it, and I could see it coming. And if I may just put something on record, which again, I don't think has come out yet. Admiral Fieldhouse took over from Admiral Eberly, I think in about August 1981. And I remember him telling me that he had attended a meeting in the Ministry of Defence with Foreign Office officials, which they had gone through the contingency plans, i.e. for all the remaining dependencies, and who was going to be doing what. And it was one of his prime responsibilities just to brief himself on these. And he had asked for the contingency plan for the Falklands and discovered there wasn't one. And he had said, why not? And because he knew that if ever there was going to be one that was going to be his baby, this was it. It had apparently not been challenged before. And they said for him not to worry, that it was all in hand, and they had been negotiating this, and they could handle this, no problem. And he let it go. And then there was the controversy over Christmas 81 of Endurance, the ice patrol ship, who, as part of the defence cuts, defence review, had been told that this was their last patrol, that they were just going on and they were going to be scrapped. And Captain Nick Barker, who I had briefed and knew quite well, was clearly extremely concerned about this. And especially when it was revealed that only £3 million were going to be saved. And I understand that Lord Carrington personally went to Mrs. Thatcher to plead with her not to include Endurance because of the appalling signal that it would send Galtieri about our lack of commitment. And she overruled him. And I believe this was the root of that war. And we then watched as Endurance went south and the reports began to come back. Almost directly he got to Buenos Aires, Nick sent his first report after the first cocktail party, sort of social gathering, which he always had before. He was very experienced. He'd been down there at least once before. And he said, the atmosphere has changed. Something is up. We are being cold-shouldered. Now, those reports were ignored by the Minister of Defence as being special pleading by Barker, who was a bit outspoken before he left. He should, you know, he was going beyond his brief and lobbying for his ship. But Admiral Fieldhouse knew his man and took them very seriously. He asked again for a contingency plan. Didn't get it. And anyway, I think at the end of, certainly by the end of January, beginning of February, He despaired of getting a contingency plan, and he got us together, his own staff, and said, I'd like you to write me a contingency plan. We finished it, I would say, about the same time as Davidoff was arriving at South Georgia, the scrap merchant, who was, of course, the try-on, testing our will. And I therefore would like that to be on record, that I believe Admiral Fieldhouse saved Mrs. Thatcher's skin in more ways than one, but he was one of the few really great men I have ever worked with, and he never put a foot wrong. And that was why we were so ready to react so quickly when war did break out. But that did worry me. And we saw the steady build-up. And then, of course, in we went to the war. And I didn't sleep for 36 hours after the invasion, because I was personally briefing the Admiral, and there was no backup team, you see, for me, because I was a day worker. And we had to keep the Soviet plot going. And then we had to really start, and I remember in the contingency plan, writing the threat, I was struggling, because I knew all about Soviets, but I thought the Argentines were our friends, and we had nothing on them in terms of the detailed weapon systems and the kit they'd got. And so I just had to say what little I could get from our known sources. But once the invasion happened, there was a complete panic, and we had to go out to all the companies that had provided the Argentines with all their ships and their weapon systems to ask them to come clean and to let us know exactly what they'd given them, what mark and mod, you know, of system. And then we had to compile a dossier of the order of battle, starting virtually from Jane's fighting ships and all the aviation space weeklies and things like this, all the magazines. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. And, of course, we had the South Georgia business first, so we had time to sort of get up and running in terms of the intelligence support team, and they quadrupled my day team in order to have people of my sort of equivalent experience and clout to be able to go into a four-watch system again, as we had for the Polaris team, which kept going as normal with the fleet chief in charge. But we then had to have three more equivalent officers to myself who were drafted in and who could take over from me so that I could take time off. And we got that up and running within a couple of weeks. So that was the way it began. And then, of course, it became a complete living nightmare, because we all thought, to start with, it was a game. And then we had the Belgrano. And I do remember I was off watch at the time. Now, this becomes very important for those who wish to promote the theory that my aunt's death, Hilda Murrell's death, was associated with documents that I might have nicked concerning the Belgrano, which personally implicated Mrs. Thatcher. And that I'd left them with her for safekeeping. Well, I can assure you I did no such thing. But the fact of the matter was I did not personally send the signal to sink the Belgrano. I wasn't on watch. I wasn't operations. I wasn't the commander-in-chief. But we had all this rubbish being produced by Mr. Tandiel in Parliament, which I then had to refute to the world's press. And my loyalty was obviously under threat. But I actually was at home when the Belgrano was torpedoed. When I got back in, I was on my way up, actually, to resume watch. I came in, and, of course, the consequences were just dawning on everyone there, and I realised that there was going to be trouble. It was extremely controversial. And, of course, then we had the Exocet attack on Sheffield not long afterwards, I think only about a day afterwards, and we realised that we were in a really nasty war, which we could lose.
Could you explain the situation about the Belgrano? You know, whether or not there was a serious threat to the fleet?
Well, of course, I always felt that Captain Bonzo, the commanding officer of the General Belgrano, was a very naive man if he thought that he could go and play cat and mouse in and out of an exclusion zone with two British nuclear submarines itching to get at him if they could find him. And so there was an element there of great naivety. I don't know about the political shenanigans that were going on, all the diplomacy. There's all those theories about rumours about a Peruvian peace plan and so on, which was scuppered by the sinking of the Belgrano. And then there's the controversy about her steaming back towards Argentina when she was actually torpedoed. I think all the facts have come out, as far as I can see, in various programmes like World in Action and what have you. And I don't think I can add to it, other than the fact that there was no doubt in my mind that the fact that the Belgrano was steaming northwest at the time of the sinking may have shown that she was heading back to port, but any ship can alter course immediately afterwards. It was an extremely volatile situation, and I believe that it was the sort of risk that the Argentines should have taken into account. Having said that, of course, the decision was, shall we say, caused difficulty for the government, especially when they decided not to be straight about it. And that was their real mistake, and I always felt that they must have had some conscience because they weren't straight about it, because they got Ponting to produce two versions, which led to his famous acquittal. But that has been something that has bothered me. And I suppose the other fact is that the Argentine Navy never reappeared after that. And so it was decisive in terms of the surface fleet. We're not sure about the submarines, but pretty certain they were not all serviceable and able to really go to sea. And so we spent most of the time struggling to keep tabs on the Argentine fleet, but they seemed to be in port or just sneaking down the coast every now and again. They never attempted to really form up again and move towards the Falklands. And so you can argue that the sinking of the Belgrano was a very powerful deterrent.
Did it not mark a stage in the escalation of the war?
Oh, true. And the obvious response was the Exeter attack in Sheffield. And, of course, we then moved on to the next great danger, which was that one of the major ships, like Hermes or Invincible, or one of the troop ships, could have been sunk before we had got the troops ashore. And I do believe that if that had happened, then we would have stared defeat in the face. And it was a very close-run thing. There was no doubt about it. We were absolutely on the stops. And the Argentine Air Force were extremely dashing and effective. And we have to thank God, in fact, that they were too dashing. In that they often released their bombs too low, and they just didn't have time to fuse. And so they went through the ships without detonating. And otherwise we would have lost many more ships. And the other area, of course, that did concern me was that there were clearly nuclear weapons on board our ships. And what the hell were they doing down there? And the other one was that after I left the Navy, I did speculate what might have been Thatcher's moves if we had had to withdraw, or contemplating withdrawal, following the loss of a capital ship. And there were the rumours of a Polaris submarine being moved south. I know nothing about that in terms of any facts. As I say, I never knew where the Polaris submarine was. But I must admit, from her general sort of nuclear addiction, I wouldn't put it past her. But I just hope and pray, from having known the commanding officers of the Polaris submarines at the time, that they would have known if they were being retargeted merely by their geographical shift out of range of Moscow and within range of Buenos Aires, what they were being lined up for. And if ever they had been given the signal to fire, then they would have had a malfunction and come back and face the court-martial. I just cannot believe that any of those commanding officers would have released a Polaris missile against Buenos Aires. But it really did get me thinking about the whole nature of Polaris' ability to deter. And I know it wasn't the homeland that was being threatened, but my God, the entire future of the armed forces were at stake if we had been defeated. Quite apart from Mrs. Thatcher, of course, being flung out of power. I mean, there would have been the most enormous crisis of confidence in the whole of the nation. And what the hell were we doing down there? And so on and so on. This was an unnecessary war. And so I really felt that, you know, the whole situation of Polaris was extremely destabilising, useless, and diverting resources that could be better used. And, of course, what was coming next was Trident.
Before we go on to that, how dependent were we on America for intelligence assistance?
Heavily, is the answer. We, of course, had virtually no intelligence sources on the ground in Argentina, because, once again, they were our friends. We were severely embarrassed. What we needed was a guy with a fishing rod, which was an HF aerial, on the end of a mole in Puerto Belgrano. And we didn't have one. And so we were reliant on satellite information from the States, which was only intermittent, and all this business about wonderful instant coverage 24 hours around the clock is absolute rubbish, especially if you've got bad weather and it's dark and so on. We got occasional snapshots, and of course it's quite useless because it was so old, the information. It's all very well knowing whether the aircraft carrier, the 25th of May, was in harbour 24 hours ago. It didn't help you at all. And so we got quite a lot of electronic intelligence as well for the Americans from their radar intercept satellites. But that was very confusing. Some of the characteristics were very close to merchant ones. And because there was no clearance of merchant shipping from the area, you had to try and sort out the two. And the fishing vessels were the major problem. It was a huge fishing area down there. And so you had an enormous problem with classification, and you could misidentify all the time, and there were scares. And you had to take the worst case, always. The submarines had terrible problems in actually trailing any ships. The Belgrano was the only one they found, really, certainly close to Falklands. And the nuclear submarines had awful trouble in amongst fishing fleets. The visibility was poor, water was shallow. They were always very limited in shallow water. And one of the reasons I believe the Conqueror was allowed to attack was because the Belgrano was heading for the Burwood Bank, which was shallow water, and if she got over the Burwood Bank, then Conqueror would have lost her. She couldn't follow into shallow water, one of the other restrictions of a nuclear submarine. Of course, they're so big. And so there was great difficulty in the intelligence picture. And the one good thing was that GCHQ managed to break the Argentine codes, which were not that sophisticated, and so we got a lot of very high-quality political intelligence and sort of order, well, planning-type intelligence of battle plans and things like this. But they had to first of all be broken, then they had to be translated, and then they were sent to us for our assessment. And so you had, again, a delay of something like between 12 and 24 hours. So you were always trying to extrapolate from those to come up to date. And but it was good intelligence, but it was often ambiguous, and so it involved a lot of assessment. But I like to think that on balance we had a reasonable picture of what was going on in the minds of the main sort of commanders, the Argentine commanders. The political side was a little bit confusing. One of the biggest troubles was trying to keep tabs on the Exocet supply and the Super Étendard aircraft, which of course were French, and there was an enormous effort put into trying to sort out what was going on in the French factories, in delivery systems, and then of course there were special forces put ashore to try to actually get intelligence on the ground, but they were unsuccessful.